Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our February Artists of the Month, Cotton Mather, are a band formed in the early 90s by Robert Harrison, whose smart and tuneful songcraft earned the band a small local fan base in their hometown of Austin, Texas. When their debut album failed to establish them nationally, they started a hermetic period of DIY recording on 8ATs and 4-track cassette tapes, which were assembled by producer Brad Jones into their sophomore album, 1997's Contiki, on which Harrison's increasingly nuanced songwriting is strengthened by Whit Williams' nimble guitar lines and vocal harmonies, and George Reef's melodic bass playing, as well as plenty of eccentric overdubbing. When the album was released in the UK, their fan base grew to include Noel and Liam Gallagher, who each praised the album in the British press, and invited Cotton Mather to open a series of Oasis gigs. But success in the United States remained elusive, and they quietly disbanded in 2003, after which Robert began a new project called Future Clouds and Radar. But in 2012, after an expanded deluxe edition of Contiki was released, Cotton Mather reunited and embarked on their most ambitious project yet, a 64-song cycle inspired by the 64 hexagrams of the I Ching. In the past 2 years, Cotton Mather has released 2 LPs and 2 EPs collecting songs from this project, and they're on track to complete it this year. Robert graciously took some time away from recording to talk with me via Skype about the band's past, present, and future, and we'll be hearing excerpts from that conversation throughout. But first, here's the lead-off track from 2016's Death of the Cool, the first Cotton Mather album collecting the songs from the I Ching, called The Book of Too Late Changes.
Hey, did anybody else see the cast of fools around me? You never seem to look us in the eye, but magically appear to bum a ride. And if you care to look, I think I could write you a book. I'll entitle it My Book of Too Late Changes. Hey, does anybody here know where you get to Wilco? We're roughly peers, and yet they seem to thrive. For something brave and sweet, attend to me, girls, as I read through a passage from my book of too late changes.
Particularly musical family?
Not really. I grew up in a very literary family in Auburn, Alabama. My family's from Virginia. We moved to Auburn. My father taught history there.
Okay.
I moved when I was pretty small, and I grew up there. And creative family, very literary family, but not especially musical. I was the first one to jump in that water, really. I was quite late to music. I got interested late in high school, found a guitar in the closet, you know.
Okay.
And began to piece it together. The first stuff I really wanted to play was old rock and roll, like from the 50s and early 60s, Eddie Cochran, Arthur Alexander. I was a little bit of a weird kid. I was into that stuff. Around that time that I was in my late teens, early 20s, I sussed out that my favorite English rockers, you know, where their influences had come from, and that's what I wanted to learn. So I started way back with that stuff. So I would sit around and play those songs to people who had no idea what I was doing, you know. But I wanted to be Gene Vincent. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought, where we, you know, make a start. And then, you know, we wandered from there. And then I went to Athens, Georgia. This is in the late 80s. I went to Athens, Georgia after I graduated from college.
Okay.
So, you know, at this time, REM was the ruling class there. And mm-hmm. they were lovely guys I met later. I didn't know them then. But they were very visible around town. It was kind of cool that they had stayed around Athens. And I was starting to write songs, working odd jobs, working door-to-door encyclopedia salesman, working in a coffee shop and just doing anything I could, and then cranking out these songs. I just couldn't find people in Athens who wanted to play music with me. Mm-hmm. It was a cool scene. They were so cool, they were too cool for me. And I worked at night in a place called Cookies and Company, baking the cookies. And so I'd go out to the 40 Watt Club or go out to the Uptown Lounge. And somehow amongst these hipsters, my name just became Baker. They were too cool to learn my name. They just called me Baker. Hi, Baker. You know, because I was the baker. Mm-hmm. One day I was hanging out at this ice cream shop called Serendipity, and this girl came in with cat eye glasses and vintage hipster dress. She was in her early 20s, and she was insufferably bemoaning the horrors of this town that she had just gotten out of and she had moved away from because it was just so banal and dull. And she began to describe the music and the scene. I said, "Where did you leave?" And she said, "Austin, Texas." I thought, "That's where I'm going." So I came here.
Did you start a band right away there?
No, when I moved here, I'd worked in an after-school program. I taught Montessori school. I did odd jobs again, and I just woodshedded, wrote songs. And then in the early 90s, I started a band with a cellist, which evolved into Cotton Mather, which was really my first band where I was writing and singing. And it took a while for it to coalesce into a guitar, bass, and drums thing. It started off as a very experimental project with just a lot of, just odd time signatures. I think the goal of the band originally was to prove that we could have gone to graduate school if we'd wanted to, you know, just trying to sound. We were really modeled on Fred Frith and Henry Cow and Massacre and that kind of really edgy, aggressive art rock stuff. Mm-hmm. And then one day I was playing my roommate's 12-string guitar, and I just began plunking out the beginning to George Bizet's Carmen. Boom, 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 boom. And I started singing this song, and it had a verse and chorus and a melody and a big hook. And I thought, what is that? And the song was called Pillbox Hat Made of Love. And it was our first cassette that we made under the name Cotton Mather.
She was the waitress at the St. Anne's Hospital coffee shop. Whistled George Bizet and won the Candy Striper's caveat. She spoke the languages with Sanskrit and Greek, but her talents didn't stop at that. She asks me like a lover, "What's your favorite color hat?"
And it charted on the local radio station, got voted, you know, sixth best song of the year in Austin, which I've never been on that in the top 10 Austin chart ever. It showed me that there was something else I knew how to do other than just angular, aggressive art rock.
Okay.
And I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed writing melodies and harmonies and arranging things. And so that's really the direction Cotton Mather began to go in. then there's always been an element of that art rock all the way through Cotton Mather, although that tends to not get noticed. I mean, one thing I tell people when they say, well, power pop, I go, well, wait, hang on. If most of what you do is an exception to the rule, do you fit the category? I would say no.
Right.
I mean, Church of Wilson, I'm singing with a power tool in my hand, screaming my brains out. There's nothing power pop. Power tools.
I think most people who get categorized as power pop sort of develop some sort of aversion to the term.
Well, I don't even know what that means. My late friend George Reed found it very offensive. And I don't mean to disparage anyone who loves that label or identifies with that kind of music. It's just, in general, labels can be very limiting and a little bit insulting. I mean, I think the worst label to give somebody is singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a bummer. He's a singer-songwriter. That just tells me, not a very fun guy to hang out with, you know. These labels are boxes and they're shortcuts for writers, and I think you can be a little more imaginative when you talk about a band like Cotton rather than, say, power pop. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they're writing. Let me put it that way. It's better that they're writing something.
So the first Cotton Mather album, Cotton is King, is one you've sort of distanced yourself from?
You know, a little bit, sure. I don't think we were ready to make a record. Mm-hmm. And looking back on that, I take the blame for that. I mean, you couldn't have told me at the time you weren't ready to make a record. I was, mm-hmm. you know, unstoppable.
I was listening to it just yesterday, and I think it really holds up.
Oh, good.
Like, what were you dissatisfied about?
That was very much an industry creation, in that we were signed by a new label coming out of LA that were very industry oriented. They were extremely well-meaning, hardworking fellas from a publishing company who started a label, and they were in uncharted territory, as were we. So I think nobody had a clear idea of what they were doing. We played in front of a lot of labels and they passed on us, and these guys said, we'll take these guys. So I'm forever indebted. But we thought we were maybe not with the right label. You know, we thought it was maybe not a good match. And they took us out to lunch when we were in Memphis making Cotton is King, and rolled out their one of their marketing ideas, which was one of the top guys at the label was really good friends with the beach volleyball star Karsh Karai. And he was running with that set out in L.A. Now, that meant nothing to us in Texas. You know, we don't have a beach around Austin. And you know, there's months of the year you can't go outside because it's so hot. But he thought, we're going to market you to beach volleyball fans. I think this was mentioned over beers. And I thought, oh, crap, this is not good. Yeah. And it didn't work out. You know, they were trying whatever. They were trying anything. Mm-hmm. They were attractive people, the beach volleyball folks. It would have been great if they had become fans. But we were these four skinny guys in sharkskin suits standing up on a catwalk in front of a scoreboard with Elm Records Presents Cotton Mather, and they look completely puzzled.
Here's a standout from 1994's Cotton is King, an album partially recorded at the famous Ardent Studios in Memphis, called Payday.
On a lot of Saturdays left alone, doesn't wash unplugs the shows them the world tipped on its side. Payday! It's hard to imagine if someone could freeze your hair. But they do have a wage, 'cause a job's not one of those things. It gets better with age.
We were produced by a guy who was had become a friend of mine named Brian Martin. I'm not sure Brian was the right producer for us, but I tend to think more and more. I learned a lot from him in the process. I just listening back to not just that record, but I just came across a demo made a month before we went and recorded that. And the idea of the demo was to record a list of the songs that were potential songs for the record to give to the label. And what I heard was Greg Thibeault, who's playing drums with us, was unbelievable. He was, I mean, I didn't understand at the time how good he was listening to this. I think he and Matt Hovis, the rhythm section, were great. Whit was still finding his voice, and it was mostly because I had him fairly much on a short leash. He had not been with the group that long. And I really didn't know how to sing yet, and I was just kind of barking. So I think that first record was a little bit of a mulligan for Cotton Mather because it was so early in our finding our voice. And then it really took a few years of being in the wilderness and discovering making art on the four track that brought it together to where Cotton Mather gelled into something that I responded to more. Cotton is King is an interesting thing. It's like looking back at your high school annual for me. It's like, ooh, you know, not the best picture there of me in the tennis shorts, but there it is for everybody to see. And it's an interesting thing for me to have that experience. I listen back to some of the songs and I think, well, those are kind of crafty little songs. They're certainly cerebral and they have some nice melodies. And Brian did a good job and the band played well. It's just not what I respond to. But I'm able to take that experience of knowing who I was at the time and apply it to bands who come to me making their first record.
Okay.
I'm able to help them meet them where they are, understanding the eagerness and the tunnel vision that I had then. It's been very useful to carry that knowledge into the benefit of others, I think.
Yeah, I can definitely empathize because my first band's album was definitely a case of, we've got 14 songs, let's just go into the studio and record with one eye on the clock.
Yeah, well, and that's a great point, the one eye on the clock thing. You know, particularly when you're a new band and when you're just finding your sound, the clock is not necessarily your friend.
Mm-hmm.
You need time to get it home in the studio, and that's what we later were able to do.
So do you think of Contiki as sort of like a do-it-yourself corrective to sort of an overly polished first thing?
Well, I don't think of the first thing as overly polished. I think of it as a little rushed and sort of adolescent, you know, in terms of its sound.
Okay.
But I think of Contiki very much as corrective in that I thought that it was just going to happen, that I was just going to put on the record once it was made and go, that was it. I didn't understand where I belonged in my own artistry. And it took a producer named Dave McNair, whom we were working with in between those two records. We were working in a place called the Hit Shack. And he heard us live. This is after Matt and Greg had left and we had George Reeve and Dana Miser playing with us. So we had this mighty rhythm section and we had Whit and I playing and we just sounded so tough and so good. And we were getting a lot of good feedback in Austin, and Dave came to see us and said, yeah, this is the shit. I'm going to get these guys in the studio. And he's a world-class producer, an engineer who just moved back to Austin from LA. And after a few weeks in the studio with me, he was tearing his hair out. I was frustrating him because I seemed to be a little bit dissatisfied with things. And at some point in a peak of frustration, he told me, look, I can't produce you. You have to produce yourself. I think you're a guy like Beck or one of those guys who, if I put you in a room with a four-track recorder and a microphone, you're going to make something way cooler than we can make in this expensive studio. I think you should just figure it out. And he was right. Around that time, we began driving out to this house in the country and making recordings on the four-track and on the ADAT.
We'll continue with a track from 1997's Contiki, later issued by Rainbow Quartz as a single in the UK, called My Before and After.
I think a lot of what resonates with me and probably a lot of other people about the album is how much fun it sounds like it was to make.
Oh, it was fun. It was fun. We were having a good time. And I think any time, probably in any artistry, it's exciting to catch someone at their moment of discovery. Mm-hmm. And it was lucky that way. I mean, it had a perfect alignment. It was really the peak of George and Dana's friendship. And they were the bass and drums. And, you know, we had Darren Murphy also come in. But George and Dana had a really wonderful friendship as a rhythm section. Whit and I had been woodshedding for a long time. We had, on Cotton is King, we were acquaintances, but we weren't tight. We had become really close pals and were playing guitar and singing every day, pretty much of the week. Had been doing that for a year. So we had honed our sound as vocalists and as guitarists. And it all came together at this moment where I also discovered that I like to record my own thing. And then there were the songs. The songs had taken a while to arrive after Cotton is King. After Cotton is King had a little bit of an intellectual, cerebral quality to it. Right as Cotton is King was coming out, my mother passed away. So I had this very heavy heart. And when I was out touring on Cotton is King, I felt this emotional disconnect between where I was at, wanting a catharsis, and the Fabergé eggs that these little songs were. Mm. And I just wanted to have rock and roll be more simple and more accessible. And so it took me a while to begin to find those songs. And then once they started coming, they became just tumbling in. The joke was we're making tapes and burying them in the backyard. We were not even thinking whether it would come out or not. So we had really retreated into a little fortress of making the music for the sake of making the music. I think when you say corrective, it wasn't corrective. It was an attempt to recover the joy of art making, because when you're on a label and things fail, and that's mostly what happens to people, it's extremely dispiriting, mm-hmm. because that might not be 9 months of work. It's also the 4 years it took you to get there. And to have your first record not succeed is so dispiriting. I think you hear us recovering our sense of optimism about music.
One thing I think is really cool, on the deluxe edition, there's a bunch of alternate takes of the songs, and some of them are maybe a little bit more polished or more normal, but for the album, it seems like you chose the weird one.
I wasn't sure how much additional material there was until someone who is my manager, Mike Worthington, in 2012 suggested, why don't you re-release Kon-Tiki? And so when I went and got the ADAT tapes and we began sifting through it, my friend Lars Garnson and I went, what's this? You know, this is appears to be an acoustic version of Private Ruth. And he said, this is way better than the record. I mean, we didn't really know. It was a fairly ramshackle operation, Kon-Tiki. When I went to Brad Jones to mix it, because I had recorded probably 90%+ of what was ending up on Kon-Tiki was done when I went to Brad. But I literally showed up on his doorstep with a grocery bag of tapes and cassette tapes. I had sent him rough mixes. He didn't understand that I did not know how all the tapes were going to line up. Brad's great contribution to that record was lining it all up and saying, well, yeah, here's the drum. You know, it was a work of mastery. This is pre-Pro Tools, you have to remember. You couldn't just throw it in the computer and line everything up. But yeah, it was all over the map, Kon-Tiki. And I think we chose the right ones. I do. I remember when we recorded Private Ruth, we had done the acoustic version of it that ended up on the deluxe. And I thought, well, no, I want to put drums on it. So we went out one day to the country and I put the drums on it and I played it live with Whit. He played guitar and I played drums. And then we did the overdubs. And the last thing I did was that ridiculous penny whistle where I'm just blowing my brains out on the penny whistle in the background and put the weird effects on it. But the funny thing was that night that we listened to, we did it all in one afternoon, we listened back to it, and we thought it was the most heavy, intensely dark, heart-rending recording. And we drove home feeling pretty solemn about the whole thing. Man, that was heavy. And we went back a couple of days later and brought the track up and couldn't stop laughing. I mean, it was so ridiculous. So we were in some magical bubble. I will say that. I mean, I could definitely tell we were in a magical place when that was getting made. And it was fun to make. The joy you hear in it, you're not imagining it. It really was a joyous experience.
From Kon-Tiki, this is Private Ruth.
She used to love me, and that was such an obstacle. Loving.
And it seemed like that album in particular caught the ear of the United Kingdom.
Sure.
Like, you got a lot of really good press there, and of course, Oasis later saying its praises.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get the same reception in America?
Well, no, we didn't really, and this is with no disrespect to Daryl Klingman, who had a little label called Copper in Houston. He was such a small operation, he couldn't do that much. And plus, America is a huge place. And so mm-hmm. if you want to put out a record and blanket America with it and have a radio campaign, all that, he had a decent radio campaign here. We did make it to number 12 on the non-commercial NPR chart, but there just weren't records. He mm-hmm. just wasn't in a position to press that many. And he was one guy with a phone in Houston and a lovable guy, but he couldn't really do that much. There was no plan for what would happen if we had success. Mm-hmm. What happened in England was Jim McGarry, who is an attorney based in New York, had a label called Rainbow Quartz. And a year after Contiki had been out and had sort of done a little blip on the radar in America and really not gotten, you know, we did a little bit of touring, but it was over and done. He called me. And at first I found him a little off-putting because he was this abrasive New York guy. And then he called my manager, who called me and said, what have you got to lose? This guy's going to put your record out in England. Who knows? Somebody might hear it. So we did it. And that's when it began to happen. People in London got into it. Uncut gave it a big review. It began getting great reviews. And based on the Uncut review, Oasis heard it and other luminaries heard it. And so things began to roll from there.
I read that the follow-up to Contiki, The Big Picture, didn't come out in America. It came out everywhere but America.
It's never been released on a label in America. The Big Picture was scheduled for release in September 2001, and then 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
Everything got postponed. I can't remember exactly what the chronology was. Maybe it was ready in 2000. I had a back injury. We had a lot of stuff going on. By the time it came out, I think the bloom was off the rose in terms of what was going on over there with momentum in England. And I thought it was a pretty cool record, but it didn't have the momentum behind it that Contiki did. And Rainbow Quartz was beginning to recognize they didn't have the muscle to help us get to the next place. And there had been some thinking that we would gut with another label. And we really should have, but there were some dubious business decisions made, and we waited around, it seems like, for about a year before we ended up putting it out, as we were waiting for another label to step forward who could really help us. And it just didn't quite get handled right.
Okay.
That's what I'll say about that. I'm not going to say anything more. Didn't get handled right.
I'd like to ask about the song Story of Anna. I don't speak Italian. Like, what's the gist of what's going on in there?
I was talking to Brad Jones, because Brad produced Big Picture. And when we were mixing it, I think maybe it was when I sang there in Nashville with him when I went to mix it. I told him I didn't really like the song and that I thought it might be cool if I just broke into Italian and never came back. and he said, well, that's an interesting idea. He said, you know, Robin, my studio partner, speaks Italian. So Robin Eaton wrote down the words for me and told me how to pronounce them. I sang it in Italian and made me like the song more.
Nice.
It was a ridiculous tangent, but I thought this song's a little weak. We need to have some curveball, so I'll start singing in Italian. I think the words in English are something like, she's married again, or so they say, that makes me the one who got away.
Okay.
And left with the story of Anna and then the refrain. Something like that. There is an English version. We recorded both.
Okay.
I think Brad was in favor of the English over the Italian, but I can't be sure. And I doubt he remembers.
From The Big Picture, this is Story of Anna.
She turns off your lights one at a time and says that's just the way she says goodbye and tells you the story of Anna bearing the cross of the world. She moves back to the coast, tells you she'll write her book in a postcard every night to tell you the story of Anna bearing the cross of the world. See you later.
questions that I never asked, but they've gone. Nevermore è svaniti di nostro canzone. Sposato ancora oggi giuno i giornali. Come fa l'uomo chi è liberato? È vicino la storia di Anna, sto l'uomo chi è condannato. Con gli occhi di un ragazzino.
The band Cotton Mather broke up, was it 2003? What was sort of behind the disbanding?
Well, I think there was a lot going on. One thing that had been happening was I was having some serious health problems from a spine injury that I had had all my adult life. I had an almost fatal car wreck when I was 17. And the manifestations of that over time were some low spine trouble, which were getting worse from touring. It was hard for me to take advantage of the opportunities that were out there for Cotton Mather. And that created some tension within the group, because I think that there was a sentiment that we weren't able to do all that we could, but the fact is we really didn't have money. We were invited to go play Reading in 2001, opening for Oasis, and we didn't have the dough, and then the stuff with my spine began to happen. But really what happened was that I think I could tell you specific stories that are not very flattering for anybody, but there was a tension growing within the group, and that tension could be best described as what happens to a band that's working very hard and doesn't have any money coming in. And we really were struggling to keep it going. We couldn't afford to tour. We were being asked to do things, but there just wasn't any income. And so I was trying to keep the thing afloat as best I could. In the meanwhile, Whit was not liking touring. He didn't like leaving home. He really, after 9/11, that was a pretty weird time for anybody to be getting on airplanes.
Sure.
It really bummed him out. And I think he wanted to be more of a home-based musician and not a touring musician. And when he announced that to us, we thought, well, it seems a little pointless for the three of us to carry on. Also, he thought that maybe we needed to be doing a different kind of music. And I did too. I think it had gone through many permutations, Cotton Mather. There are no two records with the same personnel, really. It's
right.
Since Contiki, it's a loose collective. Big Picture was pretty consistently just the four with Dana Miser and Josh Gravlin. But that four piece that made the Big Picture, I think, had musically, at least for the time being, run its course as far as Whit and I were concerned. As cool as it was, I wasn't coming up with songs that were going to work with that quartet.
Okay.
But there was never this moment where you said, we are disbanding, we can't stand each other, any of that.
The rock and roll fist fight?
No, none of the kind. There was Whit withdrawing from wanting to have a part in it, at least live. And then it sort of dissolved in a not wonderful way. But there was never any decision made that we'll never do this again. We all stayed in touch. But also, Dana moved to London, our drummer, and Josh moved to Minnesota, so we kind of went in different directions.
From the self-titled debut double LP by Future Clouds and Radar, the project helmed by Robert after Cotton Mather's breakup, here's a song featuring a lovely bass line by the late George Reith called Build Havana.
She gets so broken up she can't mend. And I get so blown away understand how this little apartment always stays so cold. Our love's in currency that I can't hold. We could build Havana.
blown away that I have to ask. Am I only someone here who burned your toast? I don't want to spend my years on someone's ghost. We could build, we could build Havana. We could build, we could build Havana.
Future Clouds was being made in 2006 through 2009, and then I got pneumonia and couldn't sing for a while, and I just went into producing and raising my kids and doing some co-writing. And then I was able to resume with the songs California and High Society. Those were the first ones I did as Cotton Mather again.
I listened to the eponymous Future Clouds and Radar album recently, and it seems to me like at least half of the songs wouldn't really be out of place on a Cotton Mather record.
I agree. I was still finding what that was. Mm. So about half of it seems like it was finishing the Cotton Mather chapter and starting something new. And then Peoria is the full Future Clouds freak show.
Right.
Which is what I wanted it to be. And I think I'm going to probably do some more of that.
Okay, excellent. As part of the songs from the I Ching project?
We may finish this Cotton Mather. I haven't decided. I've got all these new songs to do, and I'm not quite sure what to do with them. I'm just beginning to get my head around that. I'd like to get it all done really soon, somehow.
Could you tell me about the inspiration behind the project?
My own story with that is that I was a student of Chinese philosophy going back to college. That was my major in college, and I always had this interest. When we did Kontiki, George and I were really into this Qigong program we were doing, and we met some other students of the I Ching during that time, and I began casually consulting the I Ching and getting to know it, but not very seriously. And as life went on, it became more and more staple of my life and of my meditations, to where I would say it was a part of my daily fabric. And when it came time to make the question of new Cotton Mather music, what I didn't want to do was just make a record. I have a prejudice against bands that reform and make a record. Mm-hmm. My prejudice is expressed by me not buying their records. I just don't. I don't know why. I have the same stupid prejudice most people have. Like, well, you know, I've got the old records. They're probably the best. There's probably no reason for me to revisit this band, which is totally stupid. There's no reason that a band shouldn't continue to be good. We just don't have a lot of examples of that in rock and roll. We have examples to the contrary,
right,
that a band that revisits the studio 15 years later is usually a disappointment. So I thought, well, I don't want to do that because it won't even get a fair shake, no matter how good it is. And I had been toying with this idea for years of what if I did a 64-song cycle of the I Ching? And I had written several songs based on my experiences with readings. Because what the I Ching really is, it's not a religious document. To my way of thinking, it provides your life GPS coordinates on a given day.
Okay.
As a songwriter, oftentimes you're writing psychologically or emotionally just from where you're at. And I feel like that's the same locus that the I Ching is informing. And so putting the two things together was not very difficult. If I'm receiving a reading from the I Ching, it often is relevant to what I'm churning over at the most deep level of my being. And that's from whence my songs originate. So once I began to see that my songwriting could move along this line, I thought, well, that's a cool framework, mm-hmm, rather than just putting my arms around a batch of songs. I'd much rather fail trying to do Moby Dick than succeed with a little bucket of short stories. You know, mm-hmm, I wanted to go for it.
Here's a track from last year's Wild Kingdom, the second full-length album to be culled from the songs from the I Ching project, called High Society.
Cut and dry. Cut
frantic mother's pride. Fell down chasing breakfast when that bakery denied. Hell, I treat, all tally up to meat. One more frozen monument to urban defeat. He must have loved that mother cooking. Saw the catcher then died looking. Blood on the fingers of the local high priest in high society. Was he born of penury and scorn? Well versed in the classics and a master of form. Did he take a drink from Traitor's Lake? Move against the old guard and pay for his mistake. Dreamed of lover and Sistina. Got the boy, got the meter. And all these poets, they just do as they please. To my mother tongue and land, I talk more than I should. I tried to do some good. They shot me down in Texas, so I crawled to Hollywood. I knocked on Chicago, bought this coffin. They said your dead son best start rocking. Best start rocking. It's bad for business when you go on your knees.
California and High Society, those predate the project by 2 years. They were the first ones I did via the I Ching. I thought, well, that's cool. I had also done the three Nicole Atkins songs via the I Ching. So I had those and I thought, well, only 59 to go. let's go for it. I can't say the band looked too excited when I expressed this to them. I think they were looking at me like a dog that maybe was going to chew on a bone and drop it and run off and find something else. Mm-hmm. I think there are probably some interesting conversations about me, Charlie, when I'm not in the room, but you can't think about that.
Have you done the math? Like, when's the last time you wrote 64 songs in a couple of years?
Back in those days when I lived in Athens, Georgia, for that year, I set a goal that if I could write 50 songs in a year, I would become a musician. And I did. Now, I think maybe in December, the songs were getting shorter. I think I was kind of taking liberties with what I was calling the song. But yeah, so it hasn't really felt like a forced project. It's felt fairly organic. Ask me in June if I actually create these next 29. I mean, we'll see. But it feels pretty good. I oftentimes write songs and I don't write them down or record them and then I forget them. So I don't know how many I've written. And I've recorded plenty you don't want to hear. I promise.
Where are you at currently?
Currently, I think we've released 35 of them. I haven't gotten them all up in terms of the writings that I do on the website, but I believe 35 are out in the world and I've more or less got the rest of it mapped out and the songs. You know, I'm out ahead of the production because I wanted to raise money through the pledge campaign to not have to do them quite so haphazardly, but I'm just going to get it done. You know, if the money's there, it's there. If not, you're going to have to deal with my four track again.
Cotton Mather recently played in Russia for the first time. How did that come about, and are there any plans for doing more touring?
Man, I would love to do more in Russia. I loved it. It was the coolest place. And I'll tell you how that came about. There's a guy there named Boris Grebenshnikov, who is known as the Bob Dylan of Russia. He's a fascinating person if you look him up. He lived this rebel rogue life in the late 60s and early 70s with his group, The Aquarium. They were unsanctioned, renegade pirate rock and rollers. I think as he said it, people wondered if they were real or a myth. They were folk heroes whose cassette tapes, I imagine, were passed around everywhere. And in the 90s, he was able to actually start playing live without the threat of being arrested. He's an icon. And he has also got his own radio show. And at some point, somebody contacted me and let me know, thought you might want to know, Boris is very ill. And I said, okay, who's Boris? I have no idea who you're talking about. And, oh, well, he's a big fan of you. He's in Russia. I looked at him and went, wow, holy crap, this guy's really into us. He plays us on his radio show. Several years ago, my daughter was in eighth grade, and she was supposed to do a social studies project on the former Soviet Union and was supposed to interview somebody or draw a picture. She had any number of extracurricular things she could have done. I said, oh, I know somebody. Let's write him. So we wrote him on Facebook. They corresponded. She interviewed the coolest guy in Russia, and her classmates were extremely impressed. And then he began to correspond with me and let me know how much he was loving the new music. And he wrote me last year. He wrote me actually right after Trump was elected, essentially to express condolences, you know. And then he said, you know, we're doing our anniversary of the Aquarium. Would you care to come to Russia and open? I said, you bet we would. So it happened. We went over there. We met him. He was an amazing guy, had cool bandmates. And we played in St. Petersburg and in Moscow. And a lot of people there knew our music. That's the thing. You know, you don't know what your fans is over there because so much of the music has to be ripped because they don't have this easy access to it. But yeah, we met a lot of wonderful people and can't wait to go back.
Are there any plans to do any shows outside of Texas in the States?
I decided I should mention this to the band instead of telling you, but I don't want to do any shows until I get this thing done. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get it all done, recorded in 2 years. I gave myself 2 years to do it. We're at the two-year mark. The music is more or less done. I'll continue tweaking the songs, and I'm sure new ones will continue to show up. But the recording's not done. And George Reef, who's my closest friend, who had played on about half the new stuff, became sick and unfortunately is no longer with us. We pumped the brakes on the whole project, hoping he would be well enough to play on the second half. But he's inspiring us now, but he's not going to be there. I'm hoping it'll all be done soon. So I can't play. I can't play. I can't talk to you, Charlie. Don't call me anymore. I have 29 songs to do. I want to get them done by Cinco de Mayo.
All right, Cinco de Mayo.
That's hoping.
That's a couple months.
That's not far. Yeah. I shouldn't have said that, but you can hold me to it. I'm going to try.
And in the meantime, there's the pledge music that people can go and pre-order?
Yeah, you can go to that. We're going to try to get the 29 songs done before then, and then we'll probably pull two or three records out of that. But this one group of songs, the first group of songs I wrote after going to Russia, is the one I have targeted for this record, Native Son, and then some other ones. So I want every record in this set to be really different. I think Young Life is very different than Death of the Cool. And that's so trying to give them each their own individual sound and look.
Since I know you have to get back to work, I just have one more question.
Yes.
With the Young Life EP, you joined the club of bands who have albums that have title tracks that aren't on the album. Why wasn't Death of the Cool on the album that bears its name?
I hadn't written it yet.
Oh, okay.
I hadn't written it, no. I mean, I loved the title. And then after it, I thought, well, that's also a great name for a song. So I hadn't, the song was just, that little group of songs were done right after we got back from Russia. And they had the melancholy of the Russian culture there in it. I really love those. Except for Shepherd's Purse and Mighty Girl, those were tracks that we had in the can that I had never written any lyrics for. I had placeholder lyrics, and those are the last ones we have with George on them.
Okay.
And then the other four were done pretty quickly with Lars. And yeah, I like Death of the Cool. That's one of my favorites.
From Young Life, an EP released last year, this is Death of the Cool.
Death of the Cool. He moved with peculiar amount, and a photograph
And that's all the time we have for this week's episode. I'd like to thank Robert Harrison for speaking to Stereo Hysteria. And if you'd like to support Cotton Mather as they record their new album, Native Son, head to pledgemusic.com/projects/Cotton Mather, all one word, where you can pre-order the album, as well as tons of exclusive merch and one-of-a-kind items, including the original Master ADAT tapes for Contiki. For more information about the songs from the I Ching Project, including Robert's track-by-track commentary, head to ichingsongs.com. Be sure to tune in again next week, when we'll be listening to a set of songs about the Golden State, California. This is Charlie, signing off.